doesn't have an animal reservoir, so it can't return to us. A vaccine is an ideal candidate if in nature it produces a robust immunity in the human body, so people having once had it are totally immune for life. That doesn't seem to be the case with COVID-19. So I expect it to become long-term with us. We're going to have to learn to live with this disease. It's probably going to become an endemic disease, and so we're going to have to adjust.
We're going to have to leave it there. And I want to thank you so much, Professor Frank Snowden, Professor Emeritus of History at Medicine at Yale University, author of the new book, Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon will provide rent relief for some affected by the pandemic. California establishes a coronavirus relief fund for undocumented immigrants, and cell phone data suggests anti-lockdown protests are spreading COVID-19. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 18th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Monday afternoon, there are 3,623 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Oregon. 137 people with the virus in the state have died. The Oregon Health Authority reported 62 new confirmed and 2 presumptive cases of the novel coronavirus today. Health officials also reported 1 new coronavirus-related death, a 69-year-old man in Marion County with underlying medical conditions. A judge in Baker County has declared Governor Kate Brown's stay-at-home order null and void because she did not have her emergency orders approved by the legislature following 28 days. Brown said she would immediately appeal the ruling to the state Supreme Court to try and keep the emergency orders in effect. Nationally, as of Monday afternoon, at least 1.5 million people across every state plus Washington, D.C. and 4 U.S. territories have tested positive for the virus. At least 89,800 patients with the virus have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 4.7 million people across 177 countries. At least 316,000 people have died. New statewide guidelines announced Friday require members of the public to wear masks while riding public transit. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more.
Governor Kate Brown has announced that transit agencies must, quote, require riders to wear face coverings and provide one for a rider that does not have one. Exceptions include riders who have a medical condition or disability that makes it hard to breathe or prevents them from wearing a mask, and babies. In a news release, TriMet announced that the agency will start requiring riders to wear face masks on May 20th. The transit agency will install face mask and hand sanitizer dispensers on all bus and MAX trains and offer them to riders at the TriMet ticket office. In addition to the face masks, the agency said that riders can stand as close as 3 feet from each other. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
New reports provided by the progressive campaign group, the Committee to Protect Medicare, suggest that anti-lockdown protesters are possibly spreading COVID-19 across states. Location data captured from opt-in cell phone apps was used by the firm VoteMap to determine the movement of devices present at protests in April and May in the states of Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Colorado, and Florida. The firm created visualizations that tracked these devices up to 2 days after the end of protests in each state. The visualization showed that some devices were moving from highly populated cities to smaller towns across the states. Although the visualizations only show movement within states, data scientist Jeremy Fair, executive vice president of VoteMap, says that many devices were seen to continue across state borders in underlying raw data. Dr. Rob Davidson, executive director of the Committee to Protect Medicare, said, quote, "The behavior we're seeing at protests carries a high risk of infection. We can see protesters are going from a highly concentrated event, and then dispersing widely." Dr. Davidson noted that although it is difficult to connect the devices to individuals and cases of COVID-19, the data does suggest that the protests may still be significant in the spread of the illness. Oregon Housing and Community Services has created a rent relief program to provide monetary assistance to people who are at risk of losing their homes due to COVID-19. The program is providing $8.5 million to be used for rent relief across the state. State officials confirmed today that the funds were to be distributed to community action agencies in local communities, according to a needs-based formula. The formula weighed severe rent burden data, poverty data, homelessness data, and unemployment claims. Director Margaret Salazar noted that many people across the state are struggling with loss of income and fear of providing a safe home for their families, and she is, quote, "so grateful to get this assistance in the hands of our friends and neighbors in need," end quote. Tenants can submit an application to their regional CAA to receive financial assistance. Money will be sent directly to the landlord on behalf of the tenant. Essential workers in Washington state are keeping close tabs on Congress's next relief bill. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Public News Service.
The House of Representatives has approved the next round of coronavirus relief, and some essential workers in Washington state are watching it closely. Jose Attil is a paraeducator for English language learners in Vancouver and a member of the Public School Employees of Washington Service Employees International Union Local 1948. He says access to sick leave and protections for workers are crucial.
Permanent paid sick days and family leave. This means expanding the healthcare coverage for our uninsured and making sure that there's PPE for all our essential workers.
The $3 trillion HEROES Act passed last week extends paid leave protections from Congress's last stimulus package. SEIU wants the bill to provide increased wages so essential workers receive time and a half pay. Attil says his district is making a push to get high school seniors to complete their work and graduate, which has been a challenge. He's also been helping at Camp Evergreen, a daycare program for the children of first responders and medical professionals. He adds that with revenue declining and demand for vital services increasing, investment in state and local governments to help public employees and first responders is critical.
I would rather see the packages put out helping more in that direction rather than hearing big business making the funding that becomes available going into their coffers.
Demetrius Dugar is a security officer in downtown Seattle and a member of SEIU Local 6. Dugar isn't receiving increased pay during the crisis, but still is putting his and his family's health on the line. That's highlighted when he comes home from work to see his four kids.
They all in a rush and come hit daddy like, no, let me change my clothes, let me wash my hands, and stuff like that. I don't want you guys to touch me. I don't want anything to get on you.
Dugar says regardless of their profession, all essential workers need protections.
All of us need to be treated equally and on the same playing field. We all need the same equipment because we got to protect others and we got to protect ourselves.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Starting today, undocumented immigrants in California can begin applying for financial assistance from a $125 million relief fund. California Governor Gavin Newsom said in a statement in April, quote, "Every Californian, including our undocumented neighbors and friends, should know that California is here to support them during this crisis." Newsom's office said that the one-time benefit will provide $500 per adult, with a cap of $1,000 per household. According to the state's website, the fund combines state donations and money from private philanthropists and is expected to benefit about 150,000 undocumented adults. According to Newsom, although California's undocumented workforce paid over $2.5 billion in local and state taxes last year, they benefit from neither unemployment insurance nor the COVID-19 stimulus signed by President Trump. California has distributed the funds to 12 nonprofit organizations that serve immigrants, and individuals can apply for assistance by contacting those organizations. Applications for financial assistance will be accepted until June 30th or until the fund runs out. A growing body of racial and ethnic data reveal COVID-19's severe impact on low-income and minority communities. Nadia Ramlagan has more with the Public News Service.
COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting Black and brown communities. Looking at states that have released coronavirus data by race, researchers at Johns Hopkins University found, even with limited numbers, Black Americans account for 34% of total COVID-19 deaths, despite only representing about 13% of the nation's population. According to an analysis by APM Research Labs, African Americans in Arkansas are three times more likely to die of the virus than whites. Uche Blackstock is a physician and founder of the group Advancing Health Equity. She says longstanding social and economic policies are driving the higher infections and death rates.
And so when we talk about which communities carry the highest chronic disease burden, so diabetes, high blood pressure, these communities have carried that high burden because of lack of access to not just health care, but quality of health care.
She says COVID-19 is only exacerbating what poverty and lack of access to clean air and fresh food have contributed to for decades, noting that African Americans, Latinx communities, and Native Americans are more likely to die from chronic health conditions compared with whites. Blackstock says that in the early stages of the pandemic, racial and socioeconomic bias were embedded in factors used to determine who had access to testing, such as if a person had traveled internationally. She believes many people who may have been exposed to the virus while working in jobs such as transportation or in food production likely went undiagnosed
because they did not fulfill that very strict criteria.
Experts say accurate and publicly available racial data will help inform policies to help the most vulnerable, such as providing alternative housing in hotel rooms or dorms to help people quarantine who may not be able to safely do so at home, as well as providing paid sick leave for workers and improving access to affordable health care. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Moderna, a Massachusetts biotechnology company, announced encouraging early results from its first human safety test for a COVID-19 vaccine. According to their report, 8 participants who received low and medium doses of Moderna's vaccine had blood levels of virus-fighting antibodies that were similar or greater than those in patients who have recovered from the virus. This data has not been published in a scientific journal, but it is a step forward showing progress in the creation of the vaccine. Arturo Casadevall, chair of molecular microbiology and immunology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Health, said that Moderna's data is encouraging and thinks a larger trial can be conducted this summer. According to the Washington Post, this month the company received permission from the Food and Drug Administration to begin a 600-person phase 2 trial to begin testing the effectiveness of the vaccine. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Laura Loforti of the Vanport Mosaic Festival. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with increasing clouds overnight and a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow, we will again be seeing cloudy skies with a high of 65. Today in history, in 1980, Mount St. Helens erupts in southwestern Washington. The eruption killed 57 people and leveled nearly all vegetation as far as 12 miles away. The quote of the day is from Scottish-American naturalist, who is often called the father of the national parks, John Muir. He said, quote, Of all the paths you take in life, make sure a few of them are dirt. The Biden campaign is targeting 16 swing states, including the newly competitive Arizona, Georgia, and Texas. Plus, President Trump fired another inspector general on Friday. With more on those stories, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
States like Arizona and Texas and Georgia are in play in a very real way for the first time ever.
The Biden campaign is betting on 16 swing states this November, even ones that previously seemed solidly red. Campaign manager Jen O'Malley Dillon says the strategy includes protecting states that Democrats won in 2016, winning back states that switched from Barack Obama to Donald Trump, and picking up some that are newly competitive.
We are ahead in Florida, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Wisconsin, and Arizona. Now, I would love to win all of these states, but we don't have to win all of these states in order to win 270 electoral votes. We just need to win two or three of them in order to take us over the top.
Down ballot and largely considered red states, more Senate races now appear up for grabs in Georgia and even Iowa, says journalist Jacob Rubashkin from Inside Elections.
It's not that Democrats have to sweep the table of competitive races now. They actually have options, as it were. Obviously, they'd like to win all of them, but now you can afford losses in some competitive races and still manage to take back the majority.
Rubashkin thinks if people feel negatively about the president's pandemic response come November, that will impact down ballot candidates as well.
Even if the virus is more under control by the time the election rolls around, even if we've flattened the curve, the economic ramifications will still be felt incredibly.
The Lancet, a leading and highly esteemed medical journal, wrote a rare editorial criticizing President Trump's coronavirus response. To catch up with the Trump campaign's fundraising advantage, the Biden Victory Fund announced a joint agreement between the campaign, the Democratic National Committee, and state committees. It allows pooled giving so individual donors can contribute more than 110 times the normal legal limit of $5,600 to an individual committee. O'Malley Dillon says it will streamline political giving.
We're collaborating in any way we can on our strategies, on our way to virtually organize, looking at sharing resources and supporting candidates up and down the ballot.
The challenge of fundraising during a pandemic is partly why Michigan's Republican-turned-independent Representative Justin Amash announced this week he won't be pursuing a presidential bid with the Libertarian Party. Republican self-identified never-Trumpers say they will hold their own political convention in August. Congressional Democrats are launching an investigation into Trump's latest dismissal of an independent government watchdog. The president fired his fourth inspector general, another late-night Friday announcement. This time it was State Department Inspector General Steve Linick. Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson chairs the House Homeland Security Committee. He was critical of the oustings at a town hall earlier this month.
The inspector generals, without fear of being fired for doing their job, could do a better job. There are so many oversight responsibilities and checks and balances put into place that this executive, through President Trump, has just totally ignored.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Critics say a U.S. Forest Service proposal to log the Medicine Bow National Forest will destroy habitat for the imperiled lynx and the elusive pine marten, a small forest carnivore in the weasel family. Eric Galatis has more with the Public News Service.
Conservation groups are stepping back into the fray to stop the latest proposal by the U.S. Forest Service to allow logging on more than 300,000 acres and bulldozing 600 miles of new roads in the Medicine Bow National Forest in southern Wyoming. Connie Wilbert with the Sierra Club's Wyoming chapter says the Forest Service's own project documents estimate significant long-term negative impacts from carving out roads and clear-cutting some 95,000 acres.
The impacts on wildlife habitat, on recreational uses, on water quality from increased erosion, all of those kind of impacts, they admit, could last as long as 50 years.
A similar proposal by the Forest Service last year was stalled after conservation groups filed official objections, and the Center for Biological Diversity, the Sierra Club, and Wild Earth Guardians have filed a second round of objections over the new proposal, projected to cost U.S. taxpayers nearly $250 million. The Forest Service says the revised plan limits open roads to 75 miles at any given time and contends that thinning forests increases resilience and reduces wildfire risk from beetle outbreaks. Conservation groups say the Forest Service violated environmental disclosure laws by not identifying where within the nearly 1,000 square mile project area the agency plans to log or build roads. They say that data is necessary to evaluate the proposal's full impacts. Wilbert says the Forest Service is on the wrong side of the best available science when it comes to reducing wildfire risk.
What's wrong there is that the science does not support those contentions. There have been a number of very recent, very current scientific research projects that have been published that do not support that conclusion.
The group's official objection cites studies showing that drought and other weather conditions, not insects, are the most significant factor in determining fire behavior. Last year, the Forest Service gave an initial green light for a similar logging and road proposal, but withdrew its decision in response to strong public opposition. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
As growing seasons become more erratic, traditional farming calendars are not working as well anymore. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms, growing seasons are becoming more erratic. That uncertainty makes it harder for farmers to decide when to plant and harvest crops. David Abbas is a farmer in northeastern Minnesota.
We cannot rely, May 1st, we plant lettuce. It just doesn't work that way anymore.
So instead, Abbas is basing his decisions on natural signs of seasonal change, like when robins arrive in spring, the marsh marigold first flowers, or snow buntings migrate. He's matched up records of those natural events with 30 years of his own planting and harvest data. That's allowed him to see which events are good signposts.
So when the dandelion flowers, we might be planting potatoes and transplanting lettuce.
After a few years of experimenting, Abbas has created a site-specific farming calendar based solely on natural events. This year, he plans to rely on that instead of traditional dates. He's optimistic that the approach will help him maintain good harvests in a changing climate. And he says the process has been rewarding in other ways, too.
It forces me to observe. And what's better for farming than for a farmer to be observant?
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Iron oxide sludge recovered from an abandoned mine cleanup effort can be used to create pigment. With more on the story, here's Current Cast.
Crayons and clean water, the surprising connection on this Current Cast. In Pennsylvania, abandoned coal mines have left a dirty legacy. Thousands of miles of streams polluted by acid mine drainage. Wetlands can be used to treat the water, but in the process, they accumulate a lot of metal sludge that has to be removed, often at great expense.
And so I ended up exploring the idea that this pure sludge might have marketable value.
That's Bob Hedden of Iron Oxide Recovery. He found the rusty-colored material could be used to make pigment for paint and crayons.
If you get a burnt sienna crayon out of your Crayola mix, it is iron oxide for mine drainage.
By turning a liability into an asset, his company makes remediation projects more economically sustainable. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
The Northern Arapaho Tribe reported its fifth COVID-19-related death. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A fifth member of the Northern Arapaho tribe has died due to COVID-19, Wyoming Public Radio Savannah Marr reports.
The Northern Arapaho Business Council announced on Saturday evening that a tribal member had passed. The Wyoming Department of Health says she was an older woman with pre-existing health conditions that put her at high risk. Northern Arapaho tribal members now account for 5 of the state's 8 confirmed coronavirus-related deaths, and at least 30% of confirmed cases in Wyoming have been among Native people, who make up less than 3% of the state's population. This is in part due to an aggressive testing program on the Wind River Reservation, but tribal members are also more vulnerable to the virus's most serious side effects. Leaders on Wind River say underfunding of the Indian Health Service has led to high rates of illnesses like diabetes and heart disease. Wind River remains under a strict stay-at-home order and nightly curfew while the rest of the state begins to open up. Tribal leaders hope this will prevent further tragedy. I'm Savannah Marr.
Walter Murillo with the National Council of Urban Indian Health is urging U.S. lawmakers for policy fixes and equity in funding beyond line items for urban Indian organizations. He was one of 3 executives from national Native organizations to take part in a virtual roundtable Friday on COVID-19 in Indian Country, hosted by a subcommittee of the U.S. House Natural Resources Committee. Murillo says urban Indian health is often overlooked.
From day one, UIOs have been on the front line battling for PPE and testing kit shortages while continuing to provide services. These sudden challenges compound the difficulty in providing those services when combined with the chronic underfunding and funding and infrastructure gaps the UIOs already face. The facility in San Jose, California, for example, has had a 13% positive rate. UIOs were not allocated any Abbott rapid testing machines from the IHS or FEMA and had to fight for any testing capabilities at all. As our health workers are risking their lives every day, we need the federal government to ensure that our frontline heroes receive the same protections as all other public health employees.
Executives from the National Congress of American Indians and the Native American Finance Officers Association also participated, saying unmet needs in Indian Country are growing due to COVID-19, including in areas of healthcare, education, and infrastructure. The American Indian Graduate Center is distributing emergency relief funds for students facing financial distress amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Christine Trudeau reports.
When schools started shutting down back in March, the American Indian Graduate Center began a designated student emergency fund outside of their initial awarded scholarship dollars. Executive Director Angelique Albert said last week the fund has raised almost $250,000 and that $142,000 has already been distributed to 91 students so far.
It comes down to student emergency needs. They're no longer on campuses, so they're no longer in the dorm, so they have housing needs, they have food needs, and we're having to respond to those needs to make sure that they can just stay in college.
In addition to housing and food, the money also helped cover student utility bills, emergency travel costs, and household items. AIGC says they're grateful for support to the Emergency Relief Fund that came from the Indian Collective, Wells Fargo, and an online auction held by their board vice president, Walter Lamar. I'm Christine Trudeau.
This story is a collaboration with National Native News and the Solutions Journalism Network. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 18th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Melissa Hood and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Nadia Ramlagan, Eric Tegedoff, Eric Galatis, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, alternative radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, you hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with your host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host Dimae Roberts presents her documentary, Ing Dog Hay, Frontier Herbalist, in celebration of Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews oil painter Jennifer Gray in her studio in Silverton, Oregon. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm/give, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and today on KBOO In-Depth News, I'm speaking with Laura Loforti, story midwife and this year's curator of the Vanport Mosaic Festival. For listeners who may not be familiar, what is the Vanport Mosaic Festival?
So Vanport Mosaic is a non-profit, and we do, or at least we used to do, year-long programming. And then every year for the past 5 years, we've been presenting a two-week-long festival that is truly a kind of culmination of all the stories and collaborations that we collected throughout mm-hmm. the year. So the original festival, the way we planned it, it was a series of theater performances, tours, exhibits, documentary screenings, conversations, to opportunities to gather together around stories, what we call the silenced histories that surround us, and explore these histories through the voice and the experience of those who actually live through these histories. We are a mosaic of stories, of experiences. We are multidisciplinary, multiracial, multicultural, multigenerational, and so the mosaic metaphor kind of represents us beautifully.
The Vanport Mosaic Festival is part of a response to what you call collective amnesia about Portland's past. Can you talk about what it is that we tend not to remember and why?
Often we say history is told by official records and those who have the power of deciding what the narrative is, what is the convenient narrative that we want to preserve and continue to perpetrate in our history books, in our celebration and commemorations. We believe it is an intentional process of erasing community histories, because if you erase someone's history, you're erasing their contribution to a city, a city life. You erase their needs. You erase their artistic and cultural contribution and manifestation. So as we feel this is an intentional process of erasure, we intentionally remember. And so we feel like it's an act of resistance. That's what we say. It is an intentional act of resistance to remember together, to reclaim narratives, to reclaim the power that's always been there. Communities have the power. It's just that the less we bring attention to that power, the less people feel it and own it.
Could you talk a little bit about what is on this year's program? What stories are being told maybe for the first time?
Sure. So this year's festival originally was going to explore a question or a series of questions about who gets the American and what does it mean to be American today. We thought this was truly an important reflection to take on together as community. Then COVID-19 came about, and as a very small organization and also an organization, again, that brings its stories in physical space, in venues and historically significant places, we obviously had to cancel everything we had planned. But these questions are actually more critical than ever. So we felt that we should do something. We should do something because these perspectives truly are critical for us to envision what's next, what new chapters we're going to write together. And so many of the events that now we are offering through the virtual Vampire Mosaic Festival are they're the original event, but morphed for these different platforms. So the virtual Vampire Mosaic Festival, I wouldn't say is the same that we planned, but the intention and the collaborations are the same. And we are exploring these questions through screenings, through live performances, through music, through conversations, where we had poetry by Aaron Spriggs and Lakaya Drury. We had Standing Together, a dance performance by Damaris Webb and a series of partners. And we are entering this weekend with a very rich programming, re-exploring the idea of becoming American through a conversation. Sorry, I'm going to stop 1 second because I feel like I can't list all these events.
Sure, that's fine. Don't worry about that. Just give us a couple.
Yes, okay. It's very hard. Okay. So the stories are explored through a series of what I'm calling a season of hope, moral imagination, and solidarity. So instead of think of a festival as a confined, defined series of events in a place, you know, we have pretty much as much room as we want because we are not confined in a physical space. So we have, I think by now, probably over 20 events from, again, we started May 8th. We are going to go until May 30th when we close the event. We close the festival with the Vampire Day of Remembrance. May 30th is the anniversary of the Vampire Flood. And every year through the festival, we always explore this history that still people don't know. And it's a critical chapter of our local history to understand our current city and city dynamics and challenges. And so this year, we couldn't do our annual port reunion for the former residents. We couldn't do the proclamation. We couldn't do the full day at Expo Center where we gather in the physical space that used to be the Vampire City. But we are going to culminate the festival in a full day of presentations, oral history screenings, music, and truly responding to all the questions about what the legacy of Vampire is and what are the lessons from that time and all the other chapters of history that we explore throughout the festival. What are the lessons from the past that can inform us today how we address this crisis, but also how we write a new chapter? Because truly, we like to say that history is now. We look back to move forward. So every day through these events that we are offering online, you can learn something that happened to a community and how that community overcame, and what are the lessons of resiliency and imagination and solidarity that we can apply to our survival today.
Could you tell us what is on this year's program?
As we explore this idea, who gets to be American, we can't not dive deep into the story of immigration. And so among the many events truly reflecting on this experience, especially in the climate of current xenophobia, I would suggest to not to miss the ISM project, My Media Rights. They are presenting two monologues, See Her Strength by Samson Sierra, and Harvest, which is written by Dina Roberts, who is the director of media rights, and performed by Jane Vogel-Mantieri. And they are monologues that explore from a personal perspective what it means to be an immigrant. It follows four generations of Asian Americans reflecting on the family history with the Oregon's exclusion laws. And then we have a collaboration with the Immigrant Story and Sankar Ranan, who is being curating these conversations, Becoming American. And so there is a conversation with Ramiza Goya, the author of The Royal Abdul, and then a conversation with Jennifer Fang, who is an historian, and she's going to talk about the history of the Chinese exclusion in Oregon. And the beauty of a virtual festival is that everybody can participate. These events are live, so there are ways to interact on Facebook. The events also are archived on our Facebook page, but also on our website. So this is becoming a living archive of this moment in history and the reflections and experiences of many artists and many community members. All these stories and perspectives tell a much larger narrative. What it is, it's the opportunity to create a new story, because if we don't understand this mosaic of experiences and as complicated and truly sometimes appalling, we can tell a different story. And this is an opportunity right now to really use our imagination, because we have nothing to lose and everything to gain creating a very different story together.
If people want to attend the Vanport Mosaic Festival online, how can they do that?
I would suggest that they go on our website, vanportmosaic.org. If you want to interact, you can go on our Facebook page, and events go live at the time that we set in the program. And you can watch them even afterwards. They are archived and they are available. Don't miss them, no matter if you watch them live or at your own pace later on.
I've been speaking today with story midwife and festival curator Laura Loforti, who has curated this year's Vanport Mosaic Festival in Portland, Oregon, which is a virtual festival about community memory, exploring the question of what it means to be an American. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am Suzanne LeGrand for KBOO In-Depth News on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. My name is Suzanne LeGrand, and today on KBOO Community Radio In-Depth News, I'm speaking with Andy Miller, who is the Executive Director for Human Solutions in Portland. To start, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what Human Solutions does.
So we are a 31-year-old nonprofit organization that's anchored in East Portland and East Multnomah County. So we serve pretty much from 82nd Avenue on out. Our focus areas are East Portland and Gresham. And we do a number of things in advance of our mission, which is to counter the forces that are keeping people and communities in poverty. Essentially, what our work boils down to is the development and operation of affordable rental housing across East County for folks who can't afford housing in the market. We provide a set of services I would loosely label homeless services. So we operate two shelters for people experiencing homelessness, and then provide a range of supportive programming to help primarily families transition out of homelessness.
How has your work changed since the pandemic began?
So we've had some very significant pivots in a couple of areas of our work. So I'd say the biggest, most noticeable change has been in the operation of our shelter programs. We operate a women's shelter that's a 90-bed shelter in Gresham, a women experiencing homelessness. And, you know, as we've all learned through the pandemic, congregate settings are not the best places for anybody, but specifically for people who are highly vulnerable to the most significant health impacts of the pandemic. And so we have had to reduce our census in our women's shelter and worked very closely with the county's joint office of homeless services to help open a social distancing shelter in the East Portland Community Center. Essentially, what all that means is we've had to spread folks out more so that they are actually sheltering at safe social distancing from one another. And that took an enormous lift from our amazing shelter team to accomplish that piece. We've made some other pivots. We have an employment team that prior to the pandemic was highly successful in helping people, as I said, get on that on-ramp into economic security through job training and the acquisition of living wage employment. Unfortunately, the job market is such that it's very, very difficult to continue to do that work. So we've pivoted, and most of our team now is helping people navigate the maze to get unemployment benefits. So we've seen a huge segment of our workforce locally, including folks we've worked with to get jobs, fall into unemployment, and for many, the system to access those benefits and get their stimulus checks, which is really what people need to maintain economic security right now, those systems are a maze to folks. So we help people navigate that maze. The other piece is we hadn't done a lot of work before the pandemic, specifically around food security, but we've redeployed a lot of our, for instance, our after-school staff that was doing after-school in-person programming that hasn't been able to happen during the pandemic. What many families with school-age children are finding is when their kids weren't going to school, there was the issue of food security was arising because a lot of kids are eating breakfast and lunch at school. So we've been doing lots of food delivery to our affordable housing residents and our shelters, and really making sure that the families that we touch throughout the year are all food secure and not at risk of hunger. You know,
I'm curious. I was
just gonna say, beyond that, the vast majority of our staff is working virtually to make sure everybody's safe. So instead of doing a lot of the in-person meetings that we typically do with our clients, we're working over the phone. We've had Zoom meetings with residents. And all of that has really raised the issue of the digital divide. A lot of the households we work with don't have the level of connectivity that's really needed right now during the pandemic. So we've been distributing Chromebooks from the schools. We've had many of our grant funders provide technology that we've been able to disseminate out into the low-income communities and communities of color in which we work.
Moving forward, as this pandemic continues, what do you see the greatest needs are in the communities that you serve?
So first and foremost, we see there's a cliff out there that we're inching toward, and it's a rental cliff that we're approaching. So, at the beginning of the pandemic, the city of Portland, Multnomah County, and ultimately the state of Oregon all enacted an eviction moratorium, which was a wonderful thing. It meant that folks who were experiencing income loss weren't going to experience homelessness right away. because it put a moratorium on non-payment evictions. What it didn't do is erase the obligation to pay rent. It just deferred in time until we come out of the state of emergency, the point at which people will face a consequence for not paying their rent. We know, due to the massive income loss that a lot of folks in the community have experienced, they are unable to pay rent and won't be better able to pay rent when the pandemic reaches a point where we can go back to something closer to normal life. So what that presents is a cliff that we know is out there, and we don't want to see people fall off that cliff. So what we need is a massive influx of rental assistance, really from the federal government. I think the amount I've heard nationally is $100 billion in rental assistance, from which Oregon would be estimated to benefit at around $1 billion. And that's probably what's going to be needed to help folks make up whatever rental deficit they've experienced. The other option would be to erase any rent deficit that was developed as a result of the pandemic. So folks who may have lost their jobs or experienced income loss would not be liable to repay that rent. The challenge with that scenario, and advocates have been pushing heavily for a rent holiday, it's termed various things, a rent abatement period, is that when tenants don't pay their rent, landlords still have expenses to meet. And we recognize this as an affordable housing landlord. We still have a mortgage to pay. We have maintenance expenses to meet. And for many landlords, the only income they have to meet those expenses is the income from rents. So there's a real challenge there ahead, and we think, frankly, that the provision of appropriately scaled amounts of rent assistance is what's going to be needed to prevent many, many folks from falling over that cliff.
How likely is it, do you think, that either one of those options will be happening, or do you see that there's are people favoring one or the other?
Yes, I think because of the issue of, for lack of a better phrase, the continuity of our economic model, in which resources are obligated up the ladder, so the tenant pays their rent to the landlord pays their mortgage to the bank, that the rental assistance option is considered the more holistic solution. So I think that's what we would favor, as long as it's scaled to be comprehensive. And by that I mean it doesn't leave anybody out. We can't just put some rental assistance into the system that doesn't meet the need that exists across the community. So will we have the fortitude as a nation to actually meet the economic need that's the result of the pandemic, but really decades of economic injustice that stand behind that came before that pandemic? Will we have the fortitude to meet that need in a comprehensive way? It's too soon to say, but I tend to be an optimistic person, and I do feel some level of hope in some of the things that I'm seeing around our community.
Mm-hmm. What would you say are the more longer-term solutions that we need to work on in order to really see a change in society, given that the situation as it is cannot continue?
Yeah. Well, what the pandemic has done is it's exposed maybe for more people than we're seeing it prior to the pandemic, the deep roots of racial and economic injustice that have existed for centuries, really a as long as we've been a nation. So our basic political economic system has never served black and brown communities, people with disabilities, single mothers with children. All those communities and populations experience disproportionate levels of poverty and homelessness. The pandemic has only exposed that to more people than were seeing it prior to the pandemic. You know, from our perspective, the kinds of things we were working on before COVID-19 hit likely aren't going to change that much. We've been trying to build a new housing sector that's not market-based, one in which renters experience a level of affordability, stability, and overall housing security that's similar to American homeowners. So what that looks like is, a greatly reduced level of housing instability because people can afford their housing and because the people have a latitude to exercise their personal autonomy within what they call their home, whether they rent it or own it. So that's really what a social housing sector looks like. We've never built that well here in the United States, and we have the things like homelessness and high levels of housing insecurity to show it. So we may never get everybody to the same level of income, but we can ensure that regardless of your level of income, housing and having a home is a human right in the United States, and it's one that the government spares no expense to see that everyone is accorded that right. And similarly, we need to change the narrative about homelessness. Too much of the narrative is around personal responsibility and poor personal choices, when the root causes of homelessness have very little to do with that and much more to do with our basic housing system and how housing is provided.
Could you say more about that?
Yeah. Again, it's been well demonstrated that there has always been a sector of the population that is not well served by our market-based housing system. There are folks who can't afford their housing, and there are folks who similarly, for a variety of reasons, may have more challenges complying with a landlord-tenant model, a traditional landlord-tenant model of housing provision. So what we see when we look at places like Finland, Scotland, we see very, very low rates of street homelessness, very, very low rates of housing insecurity because the government has undertaken to ensure that housing is provided for everyone. I would point out that, you know, major cities in those countries, namely Glasgow and Helsinki, have higher rates of opioid addiction than does, for instance, Multnomah County, but substantially lower rates of homelessness. So when we focus on drug use as the cause of homelessness, we're focusing on something that is really more about correlation than causation. And we see when housing is provided in a very different manner and means, we see that homelessness really is about housing. It's not about behavioral characteristics or behavioral health. Those issues are important to address on their own. We need more resources around addiction. But even with a population that may experience a high rate of addiction, high rates of poverty, we've seen models in which homelessness is a rarity, and it has everything to do with how housing is provided.
For those who are interested in knowing more about your work or supporting your work, where can they go?
our website, www.humansolutions.org, is a great place to go, and you can learn more about us. You can make a contribution. You can volunteer to support our work in our homeless shelters or other aspects of our work, and really just come and get to know us. We are very much a community-based organization. We like to say we don't provide services, we provide partnership with members of our community who are experiencing the forces that cause poverty and homelessness. And so the stronger and broader our partnerships, the stronger and more effective Human Solutions can be. So we'd love for people to come and get to know us and come partner with us.
I have been speaking today with Andy Miller, who is the Executive Director of Human Solutions in Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Suzanne. It was my pleasure.
I am Suzanne LeGrand for KBOO In-Depth News on KBOO Portland, 90.7
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I'm Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.